From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, risking your life to get the story, photojournalist William Gentile has covered the fighting in Nicaragua since the revolution in 1979 for UPI and Newsweek. Also today, we get a close-up look at the sweet science with New York Times sports writer Phil Berger. He's just written a new book on heavyweight champion Mike Tyson. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead brings us highlights from New York's Knitting Factory Festival of Jazz, Rock, and Electronic Music. And television critic David Bianculli previews this season's Alive from Off-Center series on public television. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
I'm Frank Stacio from National Public Radio News. The Supreme Court today approved new restrictions in abortion laws. The action came in a number of close decisions which eroded but not overturned the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortions. Pro-life groups generally applauded the decision, although many say the High Court did not go far enough. Pro-choice groups say the court has begun to take away women's rights. Details from NPR's Tony Randolph.
Calling today's ruling a giant step backward for this country, Kate Michaelman, executive director of the National Abortion Rights Action League, says it's a loss of liberty for every American. NARAL, which had concentrated its efforts in the courtroom, is issuing a warning to lawmakers.
To politicians who oppose choice, we say, read our lips. Take our rights, lose your jobs.
Randall Terry, national director of the pro-life organization Operation Rescue, says his group will continue with its civil disobedience.
We're going to launch a two-pronged offensive right now where we will blockade these killing centers. You will see thousands of people arrested in the next 2 weeks.
Terry says his group will also take its efforts into the political arena. For National Public Radio, I'm Tony Randolph in Washington.
President Bush said today he welcomes the High Court ruling. He said the decision begins to restore the ability to protect the unborn. The Supreme Court today also ruled in a case involving the separation of church and state. It attempted to draw a line between government-sponsored religious displays that are permissible under the Constitution and those that are not. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
The case involved two displays erected in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The court voted 5-4 that the first one, a creche installed in the Allegheny County Courthouse, was unconstitutional because it endorsed or promoted Christianity over other religions. The court said that the other display, an 18-foot-high menorah, was legal because it was more of a cultural display. The menorah was placed next to a large Christmas tree and a sign proclaiming the city's devotion to liberty. In their dissent, Justices Kennedy, Scalia, White, and Rehnquist wrote that the court was showing an unjustified hostility to religion. But the court's ruling today means that at least for now, a 5-4 majority remains that will uphold a strict separation between church and state. And constitutional scholars say that means there is still a majority who consider prayer in public schools and public funding of parochial schools unconstitutional. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 12.71 to close the day at 2452.77. Trading was generally light. 68 million shares changed hands today on the Dow Jones Industrial Average on Wall Street. This is NPR News. The Panamanian State Water Company today said U.S. combat troops took over a drinking water plant for at least 24 hours over the weekend. National Water Board Director Carlos Orleac told a news conference that 300 troops landed in helicopters yesterday morning at a plant 30 miles northeast of the capital. There was no immediate comment from U.S. military authorities on the incident, which came as American employees and their dependents completed a move to a military base ordered by Washington in May. Leftist rebels attacked government military residences today in San Salvador. At the time of the attack, several explosions were also heard in the Salvadoran capital. One rebel was killed in a grenade and machine gun attack on the residences. No casualties were reported among the Salvadoran military. Yesterday, the president of El Salvador's Supreme Court was slightly wounded when gunmen shot at his pickup truck, and he and his sons were returning to San Salvador from the beach. the son of the Ayatollah Khomeini will not run for the president of Iran, which almost ensures Parliament Speaker Hashemi Rafsanjani will win the post. Ahmad Khomeini said in a letter to the parliament he needs time to recover from the death of his father to consider his political future. 80 men have signed up for the July 28th election, but the younger Khomeini was the only person thought capable of posing a serious challenge to Rafsanjani. The United States today filed a protest with China, which claims an embassy investigation has concluded the Chinese army shooting at diplomats' apartments last month was premeditated and apparently intended to terrorize foreigners. The embassy's political counselor, Raymond Burghard, delivered the diplomatic note to Chinese foreign ministry officials, which charges the June 7th shooting was calculated and carefully executed. Americans, Japanese, and other foreigners narrowly escaped injury when troops fired hundreds of bullets into high-rise apartment houses. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. At the height of the Sandinista-Contra War in the mid-80s, Nicaragua's Foreign Press Corps regarded Bill Gentile as the most daring and perhaps the most reckless of the Guild. That observation, made by Scott Wallace, concludes a new book of photographs of Nicaragua taken by my guest, Bill Gentile. Gentile first went to Nicaragua in 1979 to cover the revolution. It's been his home base since 1983, and since 1985 he's been a contract photographer for Newsweek, covering Latin America and the Caribbean. Gentile's new book includes photos he took while traveling with both the Contras and the Sandinistas. Pictures of the dead and wounded show the ravages of the war, but there are also photos that show daily life in the towns and the countryside. I asked Bill Gentile if he agrees with the description of himself as daring and reckless.
I think what Scott is referring to is the fact that I, probably more so than other journalists covering the conflict, spent more time actually in the mountains covering the conflict, and that I showed a reckless disregard for both conventional ways of covering that conflict and somewhat of a different disregard for my personal safety. I would think that, yes, there's an element of truth in what Scott says.
You said you showed a disregard for conventional ways of covering the conflict, such as?
Well, what I'm referring to there is the fact that there were some restrictions, logistical restrictions, placed on journalists as far as going up into the mountains. I mean, the Sandinista government would require written permits and so forth to go into war zones, and the Contras, of course, had their own restrictions about entering into the war zones. But I was more prone to just going up into the mountains on my own volition and ignoring the warnings about press permits and letters and so forth. And I established my own network of friends among the peasants in the northern part of the country, among some of the people in the army, and even among some of the Contra types, and gained access in ways that were somewhat non-traditional, somewhat going around the normal regulated ways of covering the conflict.
Is there an example of a photo that you've taken that required a great risk, but the risk really paid off in what you were able to get?
Mm-hmm. There are a number of pictures in the book of combat. Well, a couple of pictures of combat and a couple of pictures of the immediate results of fighting. The war in Nicaragua was somewhat like the war in Vietnam. I've never been in Vietnam, but from what I've read and from what people have told me, somewhat like that conflict in the sense that it was, as opposed to being a war of pitched battles between two armies, the war in Nicaragua was very much a series of ambushes and chance encounters in the mountains in the northern part of the country. So anytime you wanted to cover this conflict, you had to go up to the mountains, either with the Sandinistas or with the Contras, and spend serious amounts of time. And that could go from anywhere from a couple of days to several weeks in the mountains, walking around the mountains with one army or the other. And the confrontations between the two sides normally started by one side or the other laying an ambush against the other side. Now, when you do this, of course, for example, if I'm with the Contras and the Sandinistas set up an ambush, then I am exposed to exactly the same dangers that is anybody in the patrol that I am with. I'm open to fire from the opposing force.
Does the side that you're traveling with make any attempt to protect you, or are you completely on your own?
Both sides in the conflict, both the Contras and the Sandinistas, made an effort to accommodate us, and this is primarily because of their perceived importance of our role in covering that conflict. In other words, it was important to the Sandinistas to get out the word that the United States was arming and training and sending the Contras into Nicaragua to fight against them. And it was important for the Contras to get out their story that they were, in fact, in Nicaragua fighting the Sandinistas and trying to overthrow the Sandinista government. So to a degree, each side would accommodate us, feed us, of course, and if we ever had any medical problems, be they, you know, infections in the feet or in your stomach, then they would try to care for us. But there was only a certain point to which this care can go. And when the fighting really came down and when you fell into the ambush, then essentially it's every man for himself, and it's up to every soldier or every journalist with the soldiers to know how to maneuver and know what not to do as far as saving himself is concerned.
Well, recently you and some other journalists were actually caught in crossfire. You weren't traveling with either side. And one of your fellow journalists, Cornel Legrau, who was a Dutch photographer, I believe, actually got killed in that crossfire. Is that something that makes you almost afraid to go out again?
Well, you're right about the crossfire with Cornell. This was in El Salvador, though. This wasn't in Nicaragua. I guess I should clarify that. It was during the March 19th elections in El Salvador. Things like that always shake you, and they always make you reconsider what you're doing. But the driving force behind a lot of people like myself is not the money that we make or the fame that we acquire. I mean, because we acquire not very much of either of those two things, but the driving force is the belief that what we do has an impact on the way people feel and think about issues that are important to us, issues like Central America, issues like Nicaragua, issues like human dignity. And because this is our driving force, things like Cornell can shake us and make us stop and think, but normally they don't make us get out of what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Photojournalist Bill Gentile is my guest, and he works for Newsweek and is based in Nicaragua, but covers different parts of Central America. He has a new book of photos called Nicaragua. When you traveled with the Contras or with the Sandinistas, were there things that you knew that they didn't want you to photograph?
Yes. You know, this whole conflict in Nicaragua, as so many of these third world conflicts are, these guerrilla wars, they are wars not just for territory and for military victories. They are wars for the hearts and minds of the population. So both sides are particularly wary of journalists seeing anything that would give the impression that the, you know, one side or the other was not winning that war for hearts and minds. For example, the Contras were very wary of being photographed during any encounter with peasants in which the Contras, would appear to be the aggressors or antagonistic or pushy around the peasants. The Sandinistas, of course, were the same. And of course, they were, you know, both sides were terribly, terribly aware of the damage that was done to the Contra movement when a young photographer, and I don't recall the guy's name right now, photographed an execution by the Contras, an execution of a peasant who was supposedly working for Sandinista state security. Newsweek bought those pictures, published the pictures, and it had devastating results on you know, the Contras' public image. So there was a lot of concern on both sides about how to manipulate the American press.
Did you ever take the photos that you weren't supposed to and get away with it?
I made pictures of the Contras while one of their helicopters was transporting military supplies, and this helicopter had the Red Cross, the International Red Cross insignia on it. Newsweek published that picture, and the Contras were extremely irritated that that picture was published.
Now, you mentioned that neither side wanted photographs of them accosting peasants in any way. You have a photograph where the camera is inside a peasant's hut, and there are Contras coming in. Were you already in that hut when they were coming? How did you get that shot?
Okay.
And what were they doing there?
Yeah. This was taken during this very long trip in the spring of 87. And what happens is you have, you know, on that particular occasion, we had perhaps 20 or so Contras in single file. And, you know, and you walk through the mountains, you go from hamlet to hamlet, village to village in single file. And depending upon where you are in that line, you can place yourself at the beginning of the line, go get, you know, when the Contras are first coming up to a hamlet, get into a hamlet, introduce yourself very quickly to the peasants, and wait for, you know, the Contras, or, you know, the Sandinistas as well, to walk past the house, or actually come into the house. What you're trying to do there is to get some type of image that depicts what you feel is the rule of interaction between the peasants and either the Contras or the Sandinistas. It is my opinion that the Contras, for the most part, had an antagonistic relationship with the Nicaraguan peasantry. I mean, there was a degree of popular support for the Contras, but by and large, I think the Nicaraguan peasants were more intimidated by the Contras than they were by the Sandinistas. And that's what I'm trying to depict in that photograph that you see in the book.
Okay, well, I want to talk with you more about your photographs, but first we're going to take a short break, and my guest is William Gentile, who is a photojournalist, works with Newsweek, and has been working in Nicaragua since 1979. We'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Photojournalist William Gentile is my guest, and he has a new book of photos called Nicaragua. One of your photos from 1986, it's a picture of a dead Contra. His shirt is pulled up, and you see blood covering his chest. His pants are all wet, you presume with blood. And standing just a few feet away is, looks like maybe a 10-year-old boy who's staring at this body and looks very disturbed, but you don't know whether he's just accidentally come across the body, whether perhaps it's a father or a brother who he's staring at. Can you tell us the story behind that photograph?
Sure. I made that photograph minutes after a confrontation between the Sandinistas and the Contras. As you say, the gentleman on the ground is a Contra. He is dead. And what happens in so many of these conflicts, so many of these battles, that particularly when they occur close to a hamlet or a village or a town, the inhabitants of the area come to check out the aftermath of the fighting. And in this case, this dead Contra, it's not a relative, and I don't think that the man is even from that area, but the kid was one of a number of peasants who came by after the fighting to check out what had happened. And as you say, I think he's very disturbed by what he sees, and it's something that a 10 or 11-year-old shouldn't see.
Is that what you're trying to show in this photograph, the kind of chance encounters with death that even young children face all the time?
Yes, and unfortunately, too many Nicaraguan children have seen those kinds of scenes with dead people laying in the streets and in the towns and in the fields of their country. And it's something that that people in countries like ours, for example, hardly ever see, but it's very commonplace there.
Well, because you've been covering war, there are many photographs of bodies in your book, and one of the very striking ones is a truck bringing bodies to be buried, and it's just a lot of bodies that have been tossed onto the truck.
Right.
It's a very gruesome scene, but probably just what you see fairly regularly when you're photographing a war. What are the standards now in terms of getting photos like that in Newsweek or in other news magazines in the United States?
Well, generally, the news magazines here in the United States aren't prone to publish a lot of photos like that. There's another picture in the book. It was taken on that same day in the same town, and it shows dead Conchas being piled onto mules, and they're being carried away to be buried by the Sandinistas. That picture was in fact published in the magazine, and there was a bit of not an uproar, but there was quite a bit of public reaction in the sense that some people called and wanted to know if the Sandinistas had mutilated the bodies or why they were, you know, they were partially unclothed. And I said, no, this was just the result of the fighting and dragging the bodies to the mules and so forth for burial. Sometimes clothes are ripped off, torn off by the explosions, what have you. As you're implying, news magazines in our country, at least, as opposed to European countries, news magazines here in the United States don't normally publish a lot of photographs that show a lot of gore.
You mentioned that in one photo, the photo of the Contra bodies strapped onto mules getting ready for burial, that, that a lot of people who saw that photo misinterpreted how the bodies looked and why they, some of them were partially naked. This seems to me the kind of thing that you might be up against a lot, that unless there's a very explicit caption accompanying the photo, that you might really misinterpret what's happening in it. How do you try to protect against that, to make sure that the context that the photo is shown in is the proper one, and to make sure that there's no ambiguity that you didn't want in the photograph.
Right. I've been extremely fortunate, and I say this not because I'm still working with Newsweek magazine, but only because it's true. I've been extremely fortunate to have a group of editors in New York working for Newsweek magazine who have been very conscious and very aware of the problems that can be caused to a journalist, particularly a photographer covering a visceral issue like the Nicaraguan issue. They've been extremely careful in exercising control over my images so that, you know, the possibility of misinterpreting these images is limited. I have a very good working relationship with the people in New York, and they care about what their photographers do, and they care about their photographer's situation in places like Central America, which can be very dangerous.
There's a photograph of you on the jacket of your book, of you in, I guess it's like a Land Rover type Jeep.
It's an International Scout.
Okay, thank you. And you have a couple of white flags on the car.
Right.
And it also says TV.
Right.
On the car. Is that the way you always travel to identify yourself as a journalist?
This is standard operating procedure in any war zone in Central America, be it the northern mountains of Nicaragua or the conflictive zones in El Salvador. I haven't done that much work in conflictive zones in Guatemala, but if I did, I would go about it in that, you know, in identifying myself in that way, because particularly in Nicaragua, I mean, and during the height of the fighting there, some of the roads were mined, and ambushes were the daily bread of both sides in the conflict. So to avoid being mistaken for one side or the other, and to just flash this relative immunity that journalists have, and I say only relative immunity in Central America, you identify yourself as much as you possibly can as a journalist with a white flag, with TV signs.
Did you ever feel that identifying yourself as a journalist made you more of a target?
Absolutely, yes. And mostly with government forces in Salvador, because journalists in El Salvador are identified as part of the problem. We are the messengers who bring the bad news. We are considered by some elements on the right as being provocateurs, as being, as I say, part of the problem there. And we have become targets to some of these people. If you recall, in the March 19th elections, there were attacks by the armed forces on journalists. In this case, two Salvadoran journalists were killed by government forces. This is after having identified themselves as journalists. They were open fired on. So it can be a pretty dicey situation.
Mm-hmm. You started off as a journalist, as a print journalist.
As a correspondent, that's correct.
Yeah, how did you switch to photography?
It was a gradual process of identification, of self-identification, of distillation, of experimentation. As a photographer, I can go more places, do more things, have more fun than I can as a correspondent. And there's another very important element in this. As a photographer, I have more control over my final product. I mean, you can publish or not publish my pictures, but you can't change my pictures. You can crop them, but you can't change them. Whereas as a correspondent, your work is a bit more susceptible to change by editors who not manipulate, that's too strong a word, but who can change subtleties in your copy that affect the final outcome.
You know what I find kind of interesting? It seems to me that a lot of Americans have given up on the idea that war is romantic. A lot of young men no longer feel that way about going off to war, but I think that there still is an incredible sense of romance surrounding war journalism, both for print correspondents and TV correspondents, photojournalists. What do you think?
I think one has to be really careful about that, in the sense that you can't glamorize or romanticize these terrible, terrible wars. Particularly, I mean, you know, we as correspondents or photographers have the luxury of being able to go into these conflicts, get our job done, and then go back to our homes or our hotel to relative safety. So glamorization of these wars, in particular the wars in Central America, can be dangerous because, well, it's just not our role to do that, and we don't want to glamorize something that we have only limited contact with. But I think that to deny that there is glamour in war, to deny that there is some excitement in war would be not very truthful either.
Mm-hmm. Have your ways of covering stories changed as you've gotten older? In other words, your idea of what a worthwhile risk is.
Yes, and now I am much more careful about weighing and measuring the risks and considering what kind of images I can make or I'll be able to make once having taken those risks. I mean, I'm much less prone to do crazy or reckless things now than I was, for example, in 1979 when I was first introduced to war during the Sandinista insurgency.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
William Gentile has been my guest. He's a photojournalist who covers Central America for Newsweek. He has a new book of photographs called Nicaragua. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, a concert with New Orleans singer, songwriter, and pianist Alan Toussaint. He's one of the seminal figures in the development of the New Orleans rhythm and blues sound, working with performers like Irma Thomas and the Neville Brothers, and writing such songs as Working in a Coal Mine and Yes, We Can. We'll hear him sing a lot of songs that he wrote. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Knitting Factory in New York is a performance space to hear music that doesn't quite fit in the mainstream, like this band, the Microscopic Septet. The Knitting Factory Music Festival is now in progress, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead plays highlights for us. Public television's Alive from Off-Center is another good place to get introduced to innovative performers. Television critic David Bianculli has a preview of its fifth season. Also coming up, a talk with New York Times boxing correspondent Phil Berger. He's followed Mike Tyson from his early days as a relatively unknown boxer to his crowning as undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Now Berger's written a book chronicling Tyson's impact on boxing and boxing's impact on Tyson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Bill Redlin. The Supreme Court today granted states greater authority to limit the practice of abortion, but the court did not reverse its 1973 Roe v. Wade decision legalizing abortion. In his dissenting opinion, Justice Harry Blackmun said the signs are evident and very ominous that the High Court will move even closer to restoring states' rights to outlaw the practice. Women's Legal Defense Fund President Judith Lightman called the decision a major setback for women, but anti-abortion groups praised the decision. In Missouri, where the abortion case ruled on today by the court originated, response to the decision was mixed. Mark Manoli of member station KWMU in St. Louis reports.
Missouri reaction to today's Supreme Court decision echoes that heard throughout the country. A spokeswoman for Missouri Citizens for Life says that by upholding the Missouri statute's assertion that life begins at conception, the High Court has confirmed that the fetus is a human being deserving the full protection of the law. Pro-choice forces say the High Court's ruling doesn't represent the opinion of a majority of Missourians, and they will begin lobbying state lawmakers to make that point clear. The Missouri case became known as Webster versus Reproductive Health after the state's attorney general and a St. Louis-based abortion clinic. The law, passed in 1986, was blocked by a federal court before it ever took effect. Webster and Governor John Ashcroft, both Republicans opposed to abortion, hailed today's decision as a great victory. For National Public Radio in St. Louis, this is Mark Manelli.
President Bush said today he welcomes the High Court ruling. He said the decision begins to restore the ability to protect the unborn. Bush has voiced support for a constitutional amendment to outlaw abortions. Police in Concord, New Hampshire, are investigating a case of arson at a local abortion clinic. Bill Boynton, the member station WEVO, has that story.
The fire at the Feminist Health Center in Concord began around 2 o'clock this morning, just hours before today's U.S. Supreme Court abortion ruling. Someone apparently threw an incendiary device through a rear office window. Quick response by firefighters limited damage to nearby shelves and pamphlets, but a fire department spokesman said an alarm system prevented the damage from being much worse. The Feminist Health Center has been the frequent target of anti-abortion pickets, but representatives of New Hampshire pro-life groups are disavowing any connection to the arson. Health center workers say the anti-abortion protesters haven't disrupted business, and, although it's frightening, neither will the fire. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Boynton in Concord, New Hampshire.
Three workers were killed and three other people injured in an explosion and fire at a chemical plant in North Alabama this afternoon. The explosion occurred at a 3M plant in Decatur, which manufactures chemicals and film. The site manager for the plant said two of the workers who were killed were doing maintenance in the area when an explosion rocked a chemical blending tank. The cause of that fire is under investigation by officials there. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Early summer is jazz festival season. In New York, where our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead is based, the JVC Jazz Festival has just wrapped up. Kevin says some of the most exciting concerts in the festival this year were booked by the Lower Manhattan Club called the Knitting Factory. They also have their own festival going on now, and Kevin says that's where the real action is.
That's Joey Barron demolishing military drum rolls during a solo concert at the Knitting Factory Festival. In a lot of ways, the Knitting Factory is the most interesting club in Manhattan. By presenting a different act or two nearly every night, it fosters a vital downtown music scene. And by keeping ticket prices low and not forcing patrons to buy drinks, It's cultivating a new audience for jazz and improvised music. The crowd there is notably younger and less well-heeled than you'd find at established clubs like the Village Vanguard. The current festival features more than 30 acts over the course of 3 weeks, spotlighting great but under-recorded players, up-and-coming young Turks, neo-funk media darlings, and a few unclassifiable mavericks. So far, the fest has produced some amazing music. Dewey Redman's marathon half-hour solos offer evidence he's our greatest living tenor saxophonist, Sonny Rollins included. And tenorist Frank Lowe led a wonderfully raucous quintet, Saxsomble, with four saxophones, including thundering bass and baritone saxes. Cutting across racial, gender, and generational lines, the Knitting Factory Festival includes everyone from noisy rock bands to 79-year-old jazz bassist Milt Hinton. On the spiritual Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho, Hinton gives a demonstration of the noble but neglected art of slap bass. Many of the bands in the festival mirror the club's eclectic booking policy. These groups blur the lines between jazz, rock, and electronic music, and between composition and improvisation. The best of the bunch is the trio of Butch Morris on cornet, Wayne Horvitz on keyboards, and Bobby Previtt on percussion and electronics. More than any group I know, they reflect the full spectrum of contemporary music. They're equally at home with high technology and the fluid unpredictability of jazz. Music is usually regarded as serious stuff, but an element of humor runs through a lot of festival performances. Saxophonist John Zorn's band Naked City plays twisted versions of movie themes and heavy metal music. The quartet Odd Job mixes original material with covers of 60s rock songs. Odd Job's singer, Shelley Hirsch, trashes the reputation of the Jefferson Airplane's Grace Slick by exaggerating her mannerisms only slightly. One benefit of the Knitting Factory Festival has been a chance to hear a few players working in a variety of different bands. Some of the regulars include trombonist Robin Eubanks, saxophonist Marty Ehrlich, bassist Mark Dresser, and those drummers Joey Barron and Bobby Previtt. Previtt led a septet that showcased his marvelously inventive writing. He, Ehrlich, and Wayne Horvitz also play in a sextet led by pianist and composer Robin Holcomb. Thank you. few of the downtown stalwarts of the festival have new records out. They include Robin Holcomb, Marty Ehrlich, the driving string trio Arcado, and Odd Job's vocalist Shelly Hirsch and keyboardist David Weinstein. In addition, A&M Records has released the first of three sampler albums of music recorded at the club. Boom periods for new music in New York are always temporary, but for the moment, the scene is thriving. Enjoy it while it lasts.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. The Knitting Factory Festival continues through July 8th. This is Fresh Air. For many boxing fans and analysts, Mike Tyson is perhaps the most ferocious heavyweight champ ever to enter the ring, but his behavior outside of the ring has attracted almost as much attention and made him a celebrity beyond the confines of the sports pages. Though Tyson's tumultuous and violent marriage to TV actress Robin Givens is over, the story of their marriage isn't. The August issue of Playboy magazine contains excerpts from a book by former boxer Jose Torres, and Torres quotes Tyson bragging about a punch he delivered to Givens and bragging more generally about his sexual exploits. My guest Phil Berger has been steadily following Mike Tyson's career for the New York Times, where he's the boxing writer. Berger has his own new book, Blood Season, in which he explains how boxing changed when Mike Tyson came on the scene.
Boxing in the period before Tyson was, particularly the heavyweight division, was in a kind of doldrums. And I happened to see Tyson on an undercard in Atlantic City. He was then maybe 6-0, 7-0 as a fighter, and he fought in a four-round prelim that lasted about 37 seconds. And as I followed Tyson, it became clear that he was going to be quite possibly the man who was going to shake up the heavyweight division, which at that point had heavyweight champions one after the other, and they all seemed to be afflicted with some kind of inertia, a sluggishness, or they simply seemed to have no interest in fighting anymore. Part and parcel of that could have been Don King, who was the promoter of most of the heavyweights in the heavyweight division at that time, and the financial dealings that many of them had with him, I think, were fairly dispiriting and ended up making them less interested in fighting than in trying to get a few bucks out of their hard labor.
If Mike Tyson came along and enlivened boxing, what was the result, do you think, of the Mike Tyson personal story? Has that been good or bad for boxing's reputation and for the interest in boxing, which is, after all, so much a part of whether the sport succeeds or fails financially?
You know, boxing is a lot like show business. It's a marquee business. When you have a low period in boxing, no major superstar, you have only hardcore fans. And as recently as about a month and a half ago, Ray Leonard's attorney said to me, a fellow named Mike Trainer said to me, you know, if you had to depend on hardcore boxing fans to enliven the business, you'd starve. So what happens when you have a Muhammad Ali or Ray Leonard is all those marginal fans turn out for boxing sort of in spite of themselves. They become interested in boxing and stay with the sport until that marquee name disappears, at which point they disappear for a while waiting for the next marquee name. And Tyson was the next marquee name. And that went beyond his performance in the ring. You know, the excitement, the liveliness, the drama, the melodrama of the Givens-Roper saga, that marriage that took place in February 88 and lasted until she filed for divorce in October, really turned it into an ongoing soap opera. And I think it helped the sport. I mean, I found that women in the apartment building that I live in Manhattan would come up to me, knowing that I'm the boxing writer for the New York Times, and say, "Oh, isn't that terrible what that Robin Givens is doing to Mike Tyson?" I mean, they were interested. Women who had, you know, would never come up to me and ask me who's the headliner at the Felt Forum, you know, that Thursday night. These women were suddenly interested in Tyson's story, and I believe that of course is very good for the sport. There was a storyline beyond the ring.
Doesn't it play into, though, the sensationalism of boxing and some of the worst stereotypes about boxers, that they're not very bright, that they're given to violence outside of the ring, that they have sordid backgrounds?
Yeah, it does, but that's part of what's fascinating about boxing, is that you have characters on so many different levels. I mean, you have a Mike Tyson that comes from the desperate streets of Brooklyn, up through the juvenile penal system, and emerges early on in his career as a guy who's a potential hero. Then you have those other strata of society mixing their lives with his, and boom, it's fireworks.
I have to ask you what you think of the excerpt of the new book about Tyson by Jose Torres, who's the former head of the New York State Boxing Commission and a former boxer.
You know,
himself.
Jose's book, you know.
Can I just point out here some of the things that he said, so our listeners who haven't read it will know what it is we're talking about? He quotes Tyson as saying that, "I like to hurt women when I make love to them. I like to hear them scream with pain and see them bleed. The best punch I've ever thrown was to Robin Givens." He brags about one night when he had 24 girls and 24 orgasms. Tell me what you think of it.
I think that what you have in Jose's book is a lot of macho posturing by Tyson that was really unchallenged by a so-called writer. In Jose's instance, the book is all sizzle and no steak. You know, it's got these flashy quotes which his publisher was clever enough to put out there as if, you know, this was the gospel about Tyson. It got picked up and steamrolled into, you know, a feeling that that Jose has some kind of truth on Tyson. In fact, it's sort of the equivalent of National Enquirer depth. And what I find is that people who read the books, both books, come up to me and say, "Hey, there's nothing there." It's like, you know, after you get through those flashy quotes, you know, the guy's not a writer. He doesn't have anything to say.
I think Tyson said to you when you were talking to him that, "I always try to catch my opponents on the tip of the nose because I try to push the bone into the brain." What was your reaction to that?
At that time, we said to ourselves, this is a guy that, you know, doesn't follow the party line, so he may be more interesting than others to cover. He doesn't monitor himself. He's got that childlike gift for saying exactly what's on his mind. But, you know, the point with Tyson and that type of violence is that he really has a romantic feeling toward violence, and it's clear in how he thinks and how he acts. When he got into that fight in August of '88 with Mitch Green, he told a friend of his, who happens to be a friend of mine, you know, I should have avoided it, I could have avoided it. But he really has a relish for violence, and the single most interesting detail I found in Mitch Green's account of the event was how moments before Tyson popped him, he moved the rings on his fingers so that they were lined up and became part of the punch. And to me, that was perfect Tyson. I mean, you know, he knows his violence, he knows how to be violent, and he's very good at being violent.
Do you like that in a boxer?
You have to. I mean, that's what the sport is about. You know, it's two parts. One just forcefulness, i.e. violence, and two, art. And Tyson, they both exist, but the sheer violence and recklessness of him are what make him so interesting.
A lot of us first learned about boxing from now classic boxing movies. And just about all of those movies, the boxers are managed by gangsters. And they're always being asked to throw fights. It's the most corrupt sport. Have things changed much?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much money now in boxing that it really doesn't pay on the highest levels for a fighter to, you know, to take a dive. You know, when the 1930s and 1940s films were made, a big payday was, you know, $40,000. Well, $40,000 now, you know, is a fraction of what a sponsor will pay to have his logo put on the mat and ring posts. You know, you're talking in the case of the Tyson-Spinks fight of a heavyweight champion, Mike Tyson, pulling down 19 point something million dollars as his end of it. So, you know, I'm not saying that it's not possible on the lower levels of boxing for there to be a fix. But the other side of that is that who cares about those lower levels of boxing? Who'd be betting so that it'd be of any consequence? Your fight's of consequence. The money is too outrageous for fighters to wanna take a dive.
What's the greatest frustration of a boxing writer?
I don't really I don't have a greatest frustration. Boxing is a great beat to cover because it's every time you go out on the road, it's for a big event. You know, we tend to be like a caravan moving from one carnival to the next, and the rhythms are kind of nice. You're on the road a week or so, you're back home for a couple of weeks, then there's another big fight, and bang, back on the road you go, and the caravan rolls into you know, a city like Las Vegas or Atlantic City, and all the important boxing people are there. It's a big event, a big fight, and it crescendos, and you go back, and you're off and running again. It beats that kind of daily grinding that, for instance, 156 baseball games and, you know, the long, seemingly interminable seasons with conference playoffs and other playoffs that basketball and football have. To me, it's a marvelous sport with marvelous characters, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Phil Berger, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Phil Berger is the boxing writer for the New York Times. His new book, Blood Season, is published by William Morrow. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Robert, how are you covering the Supreme Court abortion decision?
Well, we'll be hearing from Nina Totenberg about what the court did today exactly in upholding, as it says, a woman's right to an abortion as spelled out in Roe v. Wade in 1973, but at the same time saying that states can regulate abortion services to such a degree that many pro-choice groups are very dismayed by the court's action today. We'll be hearing from Nina. Also, reaction from those pro-choice and right-to-life groups from Renee Montaigne. And I'll be talking with two governors whose state capitals will now be places where people will try to introduce new legislation on abortions.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. PBS series Alive from Off-Center returns to TV this week. We're listening to the show's new theme, composed by Citizen M. Television critic David Bianculli previews some of the series' highlights.
One reason I like Alive from Off-Center so much is that it offers an early look at artists who might soon move from Off-Center to Dead Center. Bill Irwin is on Broadway now, starring in a one-man showcase that began as a segment of Alive from Off-Center. David Byrne, who's done something for Off-Center almost every season, has shown up on the cover of Time magazine, hailed as a Renaissance man. But there's another reason I like this PBS series so much, and that's because some of the things it shows are so outlandish and obscure, I know I'll never see them anywhere else on TV, ever. And when you watch as much TV as I have to, finding something different is half the battle and more than half the fun. The fourth season of Alive from Off-Center kicks off this week with two separate programs. The opener, by David Byrne, is called Ili Aye, which means the House of Life in Portuguese. It's a documentary about the people of Brazil who practice a religion called Candomblé, and it's a fairly interesting hour. I had much more fun, though, with the second installment of the series, which is introduced like this.
At the turn of the century, an eccentric French magician named Georges Méliès was the first movie director to use special effects to make the impossible come true. His subjects were fairy tales, fables, and reconstructions of actual events. In this program, classic Méliès films are combined with contemporary works done by three French artists in the Méliès spirit. It's a tribute to Georges Méliès, the grandfather of movie magic.
How can you ask for anything more off-center than that? There's a French guy I never heard of, speaking in French to introduce short films by and starring other French people I never heard of, all of whom are paying tribute to a French director who made films almost 100 years ago and who I only heard of once. You know that old silent movie short, A Trip to the Moon, that has a bullet-shaped spaceship landing on the moon's face? That's the guy we're dealing with here. Most of Méliès's films are lost, but his original scripts have been found. This off-center installment lets three young directors loose on those scripts, using modern techniques to make new, old movies. Since they're silent films, it doesn't help that much to play excerpts on the radio, except that the music in every piece is fabulous. This, for example, is the accompaniment to Philippe Gautier's recreation of The Seven Deadly Sins. The sets are in black and white and are highly stylized. The hero, the devil, and the seven women who personify the deadly sins are all in color, and the sight gags are truly bizarre. The hero manages to resist the first six women, but lust finally does him in and delivers him to evil. A few of Méliès's original films are included, and they're great. He was making docudramas, recreations of actual events, before even newsreels were invented. And his playfulness with the camera makes him the unofficial grandfather of Ernie Kovacs, who had the same try-anything attitude towards television. For me, the Méliès installment of Off Center is right on target. Watch for it.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. The engineers this week on Fresh Air are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Bob Alls. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, New Orleans singer-songwriter and pianist Alan Toussaint performs the songs he wrote that others made famous, songs like Working in a Coal Mine and Mother-in-Law. Also, country singer and songwriter Lyle Lovett drops by with his guitar. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.